1947. Since then, Sevilla has been an arbitrator performing its arbitration functions nationally and internationally, and has also been developing a sort of sideline as a judge in various courts around the Pacific, sitting in the Court of Appeal in a number of important cases, including the Fiji coup case. And it was in that role that he was made one of the judges that dealt with the Pitcairn Islands case, one of the most interesting pieces of criminal litigation I think that I've ever heard about. He has also a significant academic background. For 8 years, from 1991 to 1999, he was the Chancellor of the University of Auckland in New Zealand. And part of his role there was chairing the university's governing body, but he also had to do the really difficult bit of conferring views on people. In that capacity, he tells us that in the 8 years, he reckons he's shook about 32,000 hands, which is quite an impressive tally. But he's not going to be talking about hands shaking this evening. He's going to talk for about 45 minutes on the Pitcairn trials, after which he's kindly said he'll be able to answer questions. So I'm going to introduce Sir Ian Block.
Thank you, Professor Feldman, for those remarks. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I count myself fortunate to have had three careers, as has been mentioned, and in many ways, the third career has been the most interesting because of its international dimensions, not only arbitrations, but also these two very interesting and difficult and unusual cases in the Pacific. First, the Fiji coup case, of which I spoke at the latter part of December last week, and the Pitcairn case, of which I was a member of the Pitcairn Court of Appeals, a unique judicial body. The Pitcairn case, which I'm going to talk about, was described by one of their Lord Chiefs in the Privy Council as unique. It involves fascinating history, esoteric legal considerations, and human tragedy. It was described by another of their lordships as a case involving child sexual abuse on a grand scale. It also raises issues of the rule of law in a remote place and the responsibilities of the colonial power. So what I'm going to do in my time is to give you first a brief geography lesson, then a little history of Pitcairn, then a little history of legal developments, then the discovery of the sexual offending, the reaction of those in charge and the laying of charges, then the setting up from scratch of a whole legal infrastructure, then first two, not behind them. And the people sort of came to down the side of the freighter. If the weather's rough, which it frequently is, you have to jump and get taken into the arms of the longboat men, who happen most of the time to be the six acutes. Otherwise, you can go from Tahiti, probably the easternmost extremity of the Tahiti archipelago, 36 hours by chartered vessel and very, very rough seas. And that's judges and lawyers and various media people who are performing trials. There are only 49 people, the maximum population has ever had is 200. The economy is limited naturally, but it can be reasonably self-sufficient for food. And all supplies have to come in from the freighter and unloaded onto the longboats. It's Britain's smallest colony, and strangely enough, unlike other small colonies in Britain, it's not coveted by anybody else, not like the Falklands or Gibraltar, who other countries would like to have, but nobody's ever put their hand up and said, we want to pick here, it belongs to us. So in fact, the British Crown is London with Pitcairn, but it's actually four islands, Pitcairn, Henderson, DC, and Oneido, three of which are uninhabited. Henderson Island is a wildlife sanctuary and has been designated as such World Heritage. And I met Olson not long ago, the two scientists from Cambridge who had actually spent some time on Henderson Island gathering information on flora there and the insects and other animal life, particularly snails and birds. And so one of the pipe dreams is that maybe there might be ecotourism to Henderson Island. That's a long way off. Right, so that's where it is. I hope you've got some idea where it is. It's literally miles from anywhere. Brief history. It gets its name from Midshipman Pitcairn, who sighted it in 1767 on the HMS Swallow. So he goes down in history for moving his name to this little island. 1789, there was a mutiny on the Bounty. You probably read about this, or may even have seen the classic film of Charles Lawton, etc. And the mutineers on the Bounty set Captain Bligh adrift. He somehow found his way back to England. But the nine mutineers, accompanied by 13 Tahitian women and about six Tahitian men, arrived on Pitcairn, and one of their first acts was to burn the Bounty on the 23rd of January of 1790. And Bounty Day is still Pitcairn's national day. Bounty is still at the bottom of the sea. So the Pitcairn is had children by the Tahitian women, but most of the mutineers were killed by Tahitian men. Only one called Adams survived. And the various other people, other British mariners, called Nobbs, Buffett, and Warren, all the others being almost all Christian, Christian leader of the mutiny in Belgium. They arrived and they made some rudimentary laws. They created three offences. One was murder, which the penalty was death. The other was theft, which the penalty was payback three times. The other was fornication, which the penalty was whipping of both parties and making them get married. So anyway, thus it was, these rudimentary laws. In 1838, the British vessel, the HMS Fly, Y arrived, and its Captain Elliot went ashore and decided that they needed a few laws, so he wrote out some laws in beautiful copper plate, and I've seen the actual copy of the copper plate preserved in the public record office, because we had, what I'll tell you later, all these thousands and thousands of bits of paper of great historical importance. He swore in a magistrate, planted the flag on the island, and from that day they regarded the visit of the fly as important. interesting little bits. They had Queen Victoria, they sent messages of loyalty and love to Queen Victoria and sent her a chest of drawers made of breadfruit tree wood, and she in turn sent them back a present, maybe an organ that she had got commissioned a sea captain to buy in San Francisco for £25. And so they sent her another big thank you letter. Another interesting thing is in 1986 or thereabouts, all the islands converted from the Church of England to Seventh-day Adventism, mainly because the Americans had sent, the American Seventh-days had sent two pastors there who stayed for some time and converted the locals, and whereas the CME sent maybe somebody every now and again. But that's perhaps beside the point, because the next legal significant matter is the Pacific Order of Council in 1893, made under the British Settlements Act 1887, which applied to British colonies which were not colonies by cession or conquest. Colonies have to be either settled, ceded, or conquered, and Pitcairn was neither of the last two. So this would on paper apply to Pitcairn, but only to those which didn't have their own legislature, what Pitcairn obviously didn't. This act was applied to the Pacific by an order in council in 1893, but it didn't include in its various latitudes and longitudes, didn't include Pitcairn. So what to do when in 1897 a Pitcairn called Harry Christian threw his friend, lady friend and baby into the sea, and he was committing murder, and he was detained by the locals. But in the meantime, back at Whitehall, they said, well, what am I going to do about this? Okay, we'll just remove the goalposts, literally, and include Pitcairn as Lord of the Council. The Lord of the Council said that the High Commission of the Western Pacific, situated in Fiji, would have jurisdiction over all these territories, and thus it came about that somebody in a high position in the Western Pacific, Suma, arrived on Pitcairn, made himself a judge for the day, and immediately tried and convicted Harry Christian, sentenced him to death, put him on the same boat, took him back to Suma where he was hanged. This was 1898, so although the process, they went through all the motions for all, Harry Christian didn't have anyone to speak for him. No opportunity for any defence he might have. But the importance of that is that seared into the Pitcairn's psyche was the knowledge that serious crime would be punished. And they always had the example of Harry Christian to think about. Well, not much happened in the first half of the 20th century. The island court was there, which dealt with some 43 cases. There was no call on the High Court of the Western Pacific to sue for anything serious. There was one case on someone who was charged with an abortion, which was regarded as a serious crime, but for some reason they never went anywhere. So there were nothing, there were a few civil disputes about mainly the boundary dispute nature. And nothing happened until 1952. One of the first acts of the reign of Queen Elizabeth II was to do the Pitcairn Order in Council. The Pitcairn Order in Council created the Office of Governor of Pitcairn for the first time, who was to be the Governor of Fiji. And he had the right to make laws, the traditional formula for the peace, order, and good government of Pitcairn. This is a traditional formula which was misused, for example, in Chagos Islanders' case to get rid of the law of the island. It's another story which does impinge a bit of Pitcairn. So, anyway, under this power of ordinance making, which is a very easy way of making laws, the government just writes them out and says, I make the law, there's no nonsense. Two houses of parliament or anything like that. It's just the government writes the law, that's the ordinance, and that's it.
technical reason. They did another order in council in 1970, mainly because Fiji had become independent. So they transferred the administration from Fiji to New Zealand, and the governor of Pitcairn became the High Commissioner for the UK in New Zealand. And the 1970 ordinance, for the first time, created the Supreme Court of Pitcairn. This was a court without any judges. And it was said at the time, well, it might never have any judges because they're all such good people. They're never going to have anything serious to decide how wrong that was. But the Supreme Court of Pitcairn was created. And it was said, unlike the 1952 ordinance, that the common law, the rules of equity, and all statutes of general application in force at the date of commencement shall be enforced in Pitcairn. So everything was transported. I mean, you could argue, of course, that the common law and the rules of equity came with the settlers because of the Lord Horrebore case that once, in those days, once a British subject, always a British subject, to shrug off your British citizenship just by burning your Royal Naval vessel. But anyhow, that is the state of the law at the moment, and on which yours was counted, that the laws of England in force as of 1970 applied to Pitcairn. This, of course, included the Sexual Offences Act of 1956. It was held by the Supreme Court and upheld by both appeal courts that Pitcairn was a developed society where it was known that rape and indecent assault were serious crimes and would be punished. Evidence was given by various Pitcairners to that effect, and there had been discussions in the Island Council of laws relating to consensual sex with girls under the age of consent, and there was some talk about what the age of consent would be, but we're talking about non-consensual intercourse and indecent assault, non-consensual, in these cases. And Pitcairn, after 1970, puffered along. There was no English police presence. There was a New Zealand school teacher who acted as government representative, but really was regarded as an outsider by the islanders. There was this island magistrate, of course, who was related to him, not even anyone else was. And the Duke of Edinburgh visited in the 1970s, and one of the usual loyal addresses, they produced postage stamps, which is always a small industry for a tiny nation, and they had British passports, and some of them did leave and go to New Zealand or Australia, or all back up. Anyhow, the whole thing started to blow up in 1996 when officers of the Kent Constabulary visited Pitcairn. Why the Kent Constabulary, nobody quite knows, but they were asked by the Foreign Office to be with the policeman for Pitcairn. Two officers visited, and as a result, an arrangement was made that a police officer would come for 2 years to stay for 3 months. Thus it was that a police officer called Gail Cox arrived at Pitcairn in 1997-1998, and this was noted by one of the law lords, her painstaking investigation under difficult circumstances revealed a history of very bad sexual offending against young girls, such as younger as 9 and 10. So the decision was made that these offences had to be prosecuted or visited with some sanction. There was discussion at some stage about possible amnesty or Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That was not thought viable, and also it was thought that all this system of rape of young girls was so bad that it couldn't be subject of amnesty, and there was suggestion that had been going on for many years. So a decision was made to prosecute, and the men were charged, about one third of the male adult male population. It was thought that this was the tip of the iceberg, and various commentaries show there's an indication that the colonial power hadn't really done its job properly by allowing this sort of thing to go on, unmarked, unchecked for so many years. But the six charged were historic offences, some as long ago as 1969 and up until 1999. Six were charged with numerous offences, all of the sexual nature of rape or indecent assault. And so the question was, once that decision was made, what do we do? How we don't have any structure to try these offences, and so how to go about it. So the accused were interviewed in 92,000, and except one who didn't wish to be interviewed. And there was quite a time taken before they were actually charged. Because what had to happen was a lot. The government had to pass a whole lot of ordinances which set up a justice system from scratch. So you just stop and think for a moment what that involves. Ordinances creating courts, creating prisons, creating parole, creating probation, victims' rights, all the rest of it. And in one of the judgments of the Supreme Court, it was three closely typed pages of ordinances which the government had to do. So the legal advisors to the government kept churning out these ordinances to set up a viable situation where people could be tried. Then, of course, you have to appoint judges. Well, because of the proximity to New Zealand and the fact that Pitcairn was administered from New Zealand, in fact, by Consul General in Auckland, somebody called the Pitcairn Desk, and they arranged all the savings and the supplies and everything like that. So they turned to serving New Zealand District Court judges, equivalent to County Court judges, as three trial judges, two men and one woman. And then they looked to three retired High Court of Appeal judges, such as two others and myself, to provide a Court of Appeal. And there was also a right of appeal with leave to Privy Council, as there is for all colonies. There then had to be a lot of negotiation between the UK and New Zealand about the Pitcairn Trials Act, because it wasn't going to be possible to do everything in Pitcairn, such as pre-trial applications, appeals, etc., even though the trials were intended and were in fact held on the island. So the legal subterfuge was, or fiction was indulged in on the analogy of the Lockerbie case, whereby, as you will recall, little part of Holland became a little part of Scotland. So in New Zealand, wherever the Pitcairn Court, be it the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, sat, then that was needed to be Pitcairn and wasn't part of New Zealand. So when we sat, for example, in one stage in the High Court in Auckland, and the New Zealand coat of arms was Wales, we had the Pitcairn flag, the British flag, the British coat of arms, were called My Lord, whereas normally New Zealand and Australia were called Your Honour. So that was good for the ego. So anyhow, this act was very comprehensive. It was a solid treaty between the two countries, and it dealt with all sorts of things, such as extradition, and the ability to have a New Zealand Pitcairn prisoner serve sentence in New Zealand. And it's provided for the assistance to be given by New Zealand police, justice officials, etc. Of course, the interesting thing was that the British taxpayer picks up the tab, and so far the whole exercise has cost the British taxpayer millions, please note. once you've got the court set up, then you have to decide what you do. You haven't laid any charges against these people yet, because you didn't have a magistrate, you didn't have a court system. No point to laying charges against them if you haven't got any legal process. So they suddenly went up, the magistrate is an Auckland barrister, and the lawyers, all Auckland lawyers, all paid for by the government, the state prosecutor and the public defender, and they all had numerous sidekicks. They all went up to Pitcairn, solemnly went to the little courthouse on the island, and laid the charges, and they didn't have a preliminary hearing because they accepted that there were prior basic cases and what we call was a stand-up. A hand-up brief with the magistrate made an order of committal. So the order of committal for trial of the Supreme Court in Pitcairn. Now, back in suburban Auckland, and the only free courtroom in the system, somewhere about 2 miles south of Auckland called Papakura, the Pitcairn Supreme Court heard the preliminary arguments. Basically, the argument right to try these people because they weren't really British citizens and Britain had no control over them. And they had the judicature ordinance setting up the Court of Appeal and given it jurisdiction to deal with pre-trial appeals. So when the Supreme Court rejected these arguments, the Court of Appeal in August 2004 heard these appeals and the details because they're all the same in the three courts. I'm going to do that later. And they rejected those appeals. In the meantime, the trial, everyone was all set to go to Pitcairn. A huge logistical exercise because supplies had to be taken 5 to 6 weeks. You're never too sure when you could get out because not every day is it possible to land down the side of the ship on the long way because the seas are pretty rough. So they had to get huge supplies, plus everybody up there, including a lot of the media, because it was televised. The proceedings in New Zealand were televised around to Pitcairn because they are able to get satellite now and do have the internet .pn, which they didn't used to have. So, after the Court of Appeal's first ruling, the trial started on the island. Very difficult for everybody, accommodating. Fortunately, because it can hold 200, the island had enough houses, but some of them had to be done uninhabitable. The three judges and the registrar, which is one, of course, they had a rather isolated existence, because unlike, say, a judge going on the circuit, couldn't fraternize with those lots of lawyers as you might otherwise do, because they have 49 pairs of eyes watching you, so they have to be heard out the whole time. But there were in addition, there were prison officers, court stenographers, registrars, etc. You know, you name it, they were all there. And they all had to be fed and accommodated. They all needed, if they wanted to have some wine or other alcoholic beverage, they had to get a permit because of the seventh day in the latest regime, you had to get a permit to have alcohol in the island. Anyhow, at the same time as the trials were going on or about to commence on Pitcairn, another team from both prosecution and defence were at the Privy Council in London seeking leave, special leave to appeal the Court of Appeals judgment about Britain. They were given leave to appeal, but the court of the Privy Council said, well, since you're all on the island and silly to cancel the trials, go ahead, have the trial, see if you find them guilty or not, and then come back. So the trials went on in Pitcairn, and six of them were found guilty of various offences, but there were not convictions were not entered, nor sentences imposed. We all went back, and they all went back to Papakura the next year because at that stage, that brought in further arguments, and these were much more substantial than the one about Britain not having jurisdiction. These arguments were that laws had not been properly Australian law and say all the laws of England in force in 1970 apply to Turkey, full stop. So that was dealt with by the Supreme Court to New Zealand. At the end of it, they decided that there was nothing in the statute, so they then proceeded to convict and sentence each of the accused, and the sentences ranged from 6 years imprisonment to community service, or 6 years of some of the more serious rapes, down to 2 or 3 years. The judge was saying that the sentences were somewhat less than they might otherwise have been because of the unique situation in Pitcairn. That there was no appeal against those sentences. So they appealed to us in February of this year against those rulings, which we rejected, and they finally went to the Privy Council in July, where 2 weeks had been set aside. But at the outset, Lord Hoffman, presiding, said he wasn't interested in the argument about Pitcairn not being a British colony because of the doctrine of active state. The government had on three occasions, first in the 1893 order of council extending the British Settlements Act to Pitcairn, and secondly in the two orders of the council creating the government of Pitcairn in 1952 and 1970, said that Pitcairn was a colony, and he said that based on authority that was it. So that reduced the hearing time considerably to 2 days. Instead of 2 weeks, and they did hear an argument on the question of promulgation, which we've come to know. The feature of all the hearings has been the vast amount of paper that has been generated. Very serious and dedicated research was done into every document relating to Pitcairn in its history, and extracts taken from Public Record Office and other sources, Colonial Office, etc. And so we had, even the Court of Appeal hearing, we had volumes and volumes of East Light folders, which were full of documents. All of which were extremely interesting, but not all of which were terribly relevant. And their lordships at the Privy Council had all this, but in electronic form as well as in hard copy. So this shows you how coming up to speed. Now I shall now deal with the arguments which I won't really deal with what was said in each different court because all three courts really agreed on everything except of course varying emphases. The first of course was the act of state because it was said that well this 1893, the Board of Council didn't apply because Pitcairn wasn't settled. It might have been ceded, but it wasn't settled. And the argument about it being ceded was regarded as a bit ridiculous. How do you see how the population of the Republic cede something? And it wasn't like, say, Malta, which was ceded after the Holy Land Wars, or Fiji, which was ceded by the chiefs in 1874. So Lord Hoffman said that that's out. However, there are three judges in the Privy Council, and I sought you to read the CD again, look at this packet of Privy Council UK judgments, and you should get a selection. The majority decision of Lords Hoffman, Stein, and Lord Carswell was delivered by Lord Hoffman, but separate and very thoughtful judgments were delivered by Lord Wolfe and Lord Pope. All came to the same conclusion, but the latter two judgments I felt more happy with because they grappled with the issues that we had laboured long and hard over, and I felt them very satisfactory. But Lord, interestingly enough, for students of international law, Lord Wolfe did say that he was not necessarily going to accept that just because the government says so, that it's a British possession, that which would necessarily accept it. He said that many recent developments demonstrated greater willingness on the part of the courts to scrutinise the use by the Crown of prerogative powers. So it can't be taken for granted that the courts will accept that there is any action on the part of the Crown that is not open to any review by the courts of the proper foundation has been shown. Of course, he said, well, the proper foundation is shown here, but interesting, the doctrine of active state is starting to wear its thin around the edges. Then there were a number of arguments which were all rejected pretty summarily, in all the pre-court. Of course, knowing as we did that it was all going to the Privy Council, we did not treat that quite as summarily as the Privy Council did. We thought, well, you never know what the Privy Council might do, so we had to go into it pretty thoroughly. But first of all, the 1956 Sexual Offences Act was not an act of general application, and that okay, has only to be stated to be seen not to be very, very valid. And that the 1970 order didn't include criminal law, it was a loss to understand that one. And that it was not suitable for local circumstances, since frequently offences occurred, there had been no right of appeal. And the Privy Council said, well, right of appeal is purely procedural, and as long as you haven't had a right of appeal by the time you're convicted, then what are you worried about? But the real problem was the publication, because the 1956 Sexual Offences Act was never put on the board at the courthouse in Adamstown, which is the accepted way of advising fit care population what's happened. In fact, probably the government, when he made their ordinance in 1970, didn't turn his mind to particularly to the Sexual Offences Act. But the Privy Council said, well, only the ordinance has to be published. And as Lord Hope noted, the offence of rape as a statutory offence before the Sexual Offences Act was an act of 1861, which defined the act of rape and sexual and indecent assault made in the making crimes and imposed to the term, maximum term of imprisonment. Whereas the common law was also the same crimes, but no fixation on the term penalty, similar to any act of benefit of any proof. And so there was some discussion in the local council about the prior to 1970 about English law applying, and that was well documented, and it was discussed in detail, and there was evidence called from local peers that they well knew that rape would be punished because it was a serious offence. And so, as a matter of fact, the Supreme Court found, and it wasn't challenged on appeal, that it was known that the rape offence of rape was punishable and that it was contrary to the law. It was held that the carers did have some access to the various sources. They had the school teacher, they had the government representative, but they didn't need to know the previous sections, the precise sections of the Act. In fact, I would imagine that most persons charged under the Sexual Offences Act don't know the precise reading of the Act. But it was held that even in a tiny and remote community, where there weren't many resources, even though justice requires that the law be known, that it was known that rape and indecent assault were serious matters. And this was a final fact. So it was held that although there was no copy of English laws on that, in fact, somebody said, 1997, a copy of Hornsbury, Laws of England, and all the statutes of Pickle, which maybe both, but I think they're still gathering dust in the current Pitcairn Court, I was told. Then, so having decided that, they turned their mind to other arguments about abuse so that the person should not be prosecuted. And the court has to weigh in exercise of discretion whether the public interest is better served by prosecuting the person or by not encouraging the threats to justice. And it was held there was no prejudice to these people and that there's no affront to justice. The various causes, the various heads of this particular lack of due process argument was the lack of the English police presence, the incorporation of Pitcairn into Pitcairn or of New Zealand rather than English penal legislation and other machinery of justice, the failure of the government to appoint English judges and prosecutors, so the police lawyers, and the late institution of enforcement or other machinery of justice. In other words, sure, it took a long time for all these things to be implemented, to set up the courts and logistics, but it had all been in place at the time for these people in the first question, and they would have saved all this time. But the Privy Council didn't think much of that. And that was a question of delay. And so some of these arguments were pretty thin. And the Privy Council, we virtually said so, in a rather guarded way, and the Privy Council accepted what we said. So the result is that all appeals by all six appellants have been dismissed, and those who are sentenced to imprisonment will now commence to serve their term in the prison on Pitcairn Island, which is the best accommodation on the island. It had recently been built by the very accused themselves at the expense of the British taxpayer. They've been paid somewhat in excess of what they might expect to earn on Pitcairn Island, since there's not much employment available amongst the population of 49. So they're able to go there, and it's the only place in the island with a pub out top. So they will commence their return. Seven prison officers from New Zealand have accepted tours of duty to go and service the prison, again at the expense of the British taxpayer. And so that's what's going to happen. Some of them are serving community service, and I was happened to be an email from a magistrate only yesterday, or another matter that he mentioned, that in his role as magistrate, he was going to hear an application for home detention by one of them. So that's one of the sort of grafted more sophisticated penal statutes which have been incorporated into Pitcairn law. But just to wind up, what has been the result of all this? Well, the effect's been pretty devastating for the community, very divisive. There are those who staunchly maintain that these people should never have been prosecuted, there are equally a number of them, many who say, well, of course, they had to be, because this abuse had to be stamped out, and this was the only way to do it. And resettlement is not an option. I don't want to stay there because the Foreign Office has the bogey of the Chagos Islanders in the back of its mind. You know about them in the middle of the Indian Ocean, Diego Garcia, who were shipped off in the 1960s by the Harold Hills, sent to Mauritius because the Americans wanted Diego Garcia as the country base, and as opposed to take off to drop bombs on Iraq. So one of the people of that. So there, justice has been an immense cost, not only financial, but a huge effort of all involved. At last, something has happened in Pitcairn. The first sealed road is happening. It's the steep hill from where the boats land up to the main settlement, about a mile, called the Hill of Difficulty, which has been very muddy for years and now has last been sealed. What will happen to Pitcairn, I don't know, because the possibility of eco-tourism could only happen if there were flights. There's only if it is debatable whether an airstrip to take a plane was to hold judges told me that they told me some were very badly disposed towards him, some were well disposed towards him. Interestingly, the women of Pitcairn seem to be in two camps. One says they shouldn't be prosecuted, and the other says they should. But there it is. Things will shake down, I know enough. But it's been an interesting exercise for those involved. And I don't imagine it will be repeated for a long time. So I think I've just done my problem and my time to leave it, Mr. Chairman. But have a few minutes of pretty much.
The weather was fine, people went aboard and they ashore and they sold them their handicraft. They're very good at carving walking sticks, that sort of thing. Also, weaving or sewing, women did that. Postage stamps, but as I say, they're fairly self-sufficient because the island is fertile. There were introduced animals, goats particularly, and other animals, so they do have some meat. But even though the coastline is pretty rugged, there's all this fish. So, but what they do all day, they do farming, I suppose, water culture, really. And they do go to church, I think, for quite a lot. They have a resident Seventh Day pastor.
So, how many adults males
do
you have?
I think about 20.
Only six of them were.
Sorry?
And only six of them were charged.
Yes. I don't know. That's what I was told. That's what comes out of the judgment. I think it maybe there are fewer. Some of them are quite elderly, I would think. And not too many young people there are. They normally go offshore to have babies. Because there's no medical nursing service on the island at all.
I just wondered if you think the imposition of a sort of criminal justice, or I don't know if the ordinances, I suppose it also applies to civil cases, but do you think that would change the way law is used by the Pitcairn Islanders? Is there any indication that now that they've seen that the trial in this way, that they would try to bring suits themselves, or?
Well, they are fairly law-abiding. They've had this system of this lot of ordinances for many years, and so I think the thing, the They've had the system of ordinances for many years, including minor penalties for theft and things like that. Also, it's an offence to call out "ship ho" when there isn't a ship there. So they've had this, and I think the magistrates, the sort of island magistrates' powers will be strengthened a bit. And I was talking to the Chief Justice a month or so ago, and he said he was just going up there for a civil case. They haven't got any civil procedure, any rules of court or anything like that. But he was basically a boundary dispute. And I think he kind of mediated. But they are obviously more aware of legal rights, of systems and legal rights.
Six.
Well, I think one or possibly two, I'm not sure, were on probation and doing community service. So I think it's maybe five. I think it's probably five.
Why was it so important to hold the trials on the island itself? You said before that you could use illegal fiction to actually make a different part of the country, kind of part of that country, like in New Zealand, the courts were used that way.
Well, I think it was the local feeling. These are local crimes, local people, and justice must be seen, be done in the community. The complainants, of course, were back in Auckland, and they gave evidence through video links. I think because they were almost all offshore. See, after Constable Gail Cox, Cavanaugh's, every woman who lived in Pitcairn between 1980 and 2000 was interviewed. Most of them were in New Zealand or Australia, and that's how the raft of the charges came. Most of the complainants were not on Pitcairn. They were almost all were not on Pitcairn. They were captured to Papakura to give evidence. And their evidence was relayed and cross-examined by counsel up there through the video.
If I can ask another question. If I understand it correctly, New Zealand legislation is required to deem the New Zealand court part of Pitcairn.
Yes.
But as far as the UK was concerned, the whole edifice was created out of the Royal Prerogative.
Yes, that's true. There's no reciprocal or sort of mirror image legislation in England, but the treaty is a schedule to the New Zealand Act. Pitcairn Trials Act 2002. But no, it wasn't necessary.
And, sorry, a final question for me. Have you any idea what prompted the police, the Kent Constabulary, to be sent out? Were there suspicions that there might be something awry?
Yes.
Or were they just sending them out because Pitcairn has deserved a copy of the police?
No, I think, I don't know, it's not revealed, but I think there were suspicions.
Yeah. What's the construction like on the island? Is it all timber shacks?
I haven't been there. I didn't go there myself. They're too old to be clambering down the side of the creek. I think it's reasonably substantial because they do get some pretty bad weather, so it has to withstand that.
Very much for fascinating accounts of
history, legal development, and the trial process in a situation where people were having to make it up more or less as they went along. It's a lesson for those of us who are vaguely attached to the idea that law is something predictable and settled, that sometimes only a very minimal amount needs to be predictable and settled, and you can still produce the results at the end. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and talk to us. So Ian is a visiting scholar at Wolfson College at the moment. He's around for a while, and we're very happy that you're here.